From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is William F. Buckley, Jr., reading pages 923.
This is Mel Brooks.
This is Julius Lester.
This is Margot Adler of WBA.
This is Pete Seeger, reading pages...
Anne Bancroft, pages 1389.
This is Morris Karnofsky.
5 years ago, more than 170 people from all walks of life came together at Pacifica radio station WBAI for a reading of the epic Russian novel War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. Included in that reading was Tolstoy's granddaughter, Alexandra.
We had already descended the hill. He greeted the men in the foremost regiment and gave the command to advance, thereby...
It was in the midst of the Vietnam War. Today, in the midst of the war in Iraq, we talk about war and peace.
War is war, no matter what era, no matter what century.
Journalist Helen Thomas, artists, scholars, and others discuss war and peace and the significance of the historic radio broadcast 35 years ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice denied Monday the U.S. is engaging in torture and defended how the Bush administration's waging of the so-called war on terror. Rice's comments came ahead of a trip to Europe where she's expected to be questioned about the existence of secret CIA prisons and about the CIA's practice of kidnapping wanted individuals overseas. Rice did not deny the U.S. has secretly picked up people overseas, flying them to other countries, but she denied this is being done, quote, for the purpose of being tortured.
The United States does not permit, tolerate, or condone torture under any circumstances. Moreover, in accordance with the policy of this administration, the United States has respected and will continue to respect the sovereignty of other countries. The United States does not transport and has not transported detainees from one country to another for the purpose of interrogation using torture. The United States does not use the airspace or the airports of any country for the purpose of transporting a detainee to a country where he or she will be tortured. The United States has not transported anyone and will not transport anyone to a country when we believe he will be tortured. Where appropriate, the United States seeks assurances that transferred persons will not be tortured.
That was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Officials from Human Rights Watch accused Rice of failing to acknowledge the United States has transported detainees to countries such as Egypt and Syria, where it knows torture is used. The group said Rice also failed to address the existence of secret CIA prisons inside Europe. ABC News is reporting just last month the U.S. moved 11 al-Qaeda suspects from a secret site in Europe to somewhere in North Africa. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has uncovered new information about one of the best-known cases of extraordinary rendition, the CIA's kidnapping of the Islamic cleric Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser. According to the Post, the CIA purposely misled the Italian government about his disappearance by claiming he'd fled to the Balkans. In fact, he disappeared after a team of CIA agents abducted him from the streets of Milan and secretly flew him to Egypt, where he was interrogated and allegedly tortured. An Italian judge has ordered the arrest of over 20 CIA agents involved in the kidnapping. In Iraq, at least 27 people have died after two female suicide bombers blew themselves up earlier today inside Baghdad's police academy. Iraqi police said the women were likely students at the police academy who were able to enter the building without being searched. The bombings come just a day after Iraq's vice president, Ghazi al-Yawar, publicly disputed comments made last week by President Bush about the improved state of the Iraqi security forces. Al-Yawar said the training of Iraqi security forces has suffered a big setback in recent months because the army and other forces have been increasingly used to settle personal and political scores. In addition, al-Yawar warned armed Shiite militias in the south might be trying to incite civil war in Iraq. In other news from Iraq, a prominent Muslim anti-war activist from Britain has arrived in Iraq in order to help secure the release of the four kidnapped peace activists with the Christian Peacemaker team. Anas Altakriti spoke in Baghdad on Monday.
The objective of the mission is simple and clear. That is, to issue an appeal to the captors, to release the four hostages and tell them that these are friends of Iraq and the Iraqi people, and in particular, the British national Norman Kember, who is aged 74 and who is a retired professor. They have dedicated their lives in combating terrorism and violence and call for peace.
That was Anas Altakriti. The former members of the 9/11 Commission warned Monday that the U.S. is dangerously unprepared for another domestic attack. This is Thomas Kane, the president of the now disbanded 9/11 Commission.
Are we safe? And the answer is, of course, that we are safer, but we are not yet safe. 4 years after 9/11, we are not as safe as we could be. And that's simply not acceptable. Look at this report card. There are far too many C's, D's, and F's in this report card that we are going to issue today. And there are many things, as I go around the country and talk to the American people, there are many things that people think have been done that simply haven't been done. Our leadership has been distracted in this country. Some of the failures are shocking.
Former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane, head of the 9/11 Commission. The commissioners gave the government a grade of C, D, or F in about half the categories, including Fs for its efforts to focus Homeland Security money on cities most at risk, on improving radio communications for emergency workers, and on pre-screening airline passengers. Republican Congressmember Tom DeLay suffered a setback Monday after a Texas judge refused to throw out money laundering charges against him. The judge, however, did throw out conspiracy charges against DeLay, the former House Majority Leader. DeLay is accused of illegally funneling $190,000 in corporate donations to 2002 Republican candidates for the Texas legislature. Money laundering is punishable by 5 years to life. Despite the indictment, the Bush administration remains close to DeLay. Last night, Vice President Dick Cheney traveled to Houston to headline a fundraiser for the Texas congressman. In other political news, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton is about to face a challenge in her reelection bid from within her own party. Jonathan Tessini, the former president of the National Writers Union, has announced plans to run against Clinton. His campaign will focus on opposing the Iraq War, renegotiating so-called free trade deals, and extending Medicare to all Americans. The Nation magazine described Tessini as, quote, one of the most outspoken progressive activists in the U.S. labor movement. Meanwhile, a former Green Party candidate named Steve Greenfield has also announced plans to run on the Democratic ticket against Clinton. Greenfield says the centerpiece of his campaign will be the rapid withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. And in news from New Orleans, telephone giant Bell South has withdrawn an offer to allow the city to house its new police headquarters in one of the company's damaged buildings. Bell South withdrew the offer after the city announced plans to offer free high-speed internet to homes and businesses in the city as an incentive for residents and companies to return. Around the country, large telephone companies have aggressively opposed plans for cities to launch community wireless networks. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 35 years ago, Leo Tolstoy's classic work, War and Peace, took over the airwaves of New York's WBAI radio station, WBAI, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. It was the 100th anniversary of the publishing of the book, and it was a time of war. More than 300,000 U.S. troops were in Vietnam. The final death toll would be 58,000 U.S. troops and millions of Vietnamese, Cambodians, Laotians. Anti-war sentiment was strong. For 4.5 days, ending December 6, 1970, more than 170 people from all walks of life came together for a reading of the great Russian epic, War and Peace. The marathon reading captivated New York City.
Here is Alexandra Tolstoy reading the first page of her father's novel from the original text.
Eh bien, mon prince, Jeanne et Luc ne sont plus que des apanages.
My name is Dustin Hoffman, and I'm reading Book One, Part
This
one.
Is Buck Henry, reading chapters 20 and 21.
This is Richard Avedon, reading pages 141.
This is Joseph Heller,
Reading pages 100.
This is Elsa Knight Thompson.
My name is Barbara Oka.
This is Grandma Dottie.
This is Fay Wray.
This is Anne Donegan, translator of War and Peace.
This is Sablu Gabriel, reading part 3.
This is Thomas Stewart.
My name is Robert Moss.
This is Freddie Dundee.
This is Diane Serber.
I'm Allison Steele of WNEW-FM, and I'm delighted to be here at WBAI.
My name is Sheldon Harnick. I'm a lyricist for the theater.
My name is Marvin Kittman.
Mitch Miller, number 33, book 1, part 3, chapters 13 and 14, pages...
This is Theodore Bickel. I shall be reading...
This is William F. Buckley, Jr., reading pages 9, 23.
This is Mel Brooks.
This is Julius Lester.
This is Margot Adler of WBAI.
This is Pete Seeger, reading pages...
Anne Bancroft. Pages 1389.
This is Morris Karnofsky. In the present case, it is similarly necessary to renounce a freedom that does not exist and to recognize a dependence of which we are not conscious.
Some of the voices reading War and Peace on WBAI, Pacifica Radio, 1970. Nearly 5 days after the reading began, the legendary actor Morris Karnofsky read the famous last words to Leo Tolstoy's epic novel, ending what was at the time the longest continuous broadcast in radio history. The special had continued for 4.5 days, stopping only for music breaks and nightly reports on the Vietnam War, called the War Report. We're joined in Washington now by Professor Andy Kaufman to talk about the significance of War and Peace and its author, Leo Tolstoy. He's a visiting lecturer at the University of Virginia, where he's professor of Slavic languages and literature. He's fluent in Russian and has lived in Russia for extended periods of time. Afterwards, we'll bring you a documentary about the marathon radio broadcast of War and Peace. Professor Kaufman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
It's good to be with you. Can you talk about the significance of Leo Tolstoy and his novel, War and Peace?
Sure. Well, let me start by talking a little bit about Tolstoy, because, you see, Leo Tolstoy was more than a great writer. He was a phenomenon. He's one of those writers that actually didn't have to die to become famous. He was an international celebrity in his own day. In fact, when he died in 1910, his funeral, there was hardly a major newspaper, radio broadcast in the world that didn't cover Tolstoy's death. And one of the reasons for his celebrity is not just because he was a great writer, he was a great teacher of life. And the range of interests that his works deal with, his range of concerns, the character types, the sprawling expanse of life that he explores in his works is absolutely breathtaking. And this is why I say that Tolstoy is a kind of phenomenon. One critic called him a giant harnessed to his great subject, all of human life. And that same critic said, actually, that Tolstoy is like a vast reflector of life, like a great natural lake. And that is who he was as a person and who he was as a writer as well.
And what were the circumstances under which he wrote the book War and Peace?
Well, he wrote War and Peace in the 1860s. He actually had already established himself as an extraordinarily talented writer the decade before. Actually, as a writer of war, he wrote he became famous for, the so-called Sevastopol Tales, which was actually about the Crimean War of the 1850s, which he himself participated in. And this was the work that he wrote, I think it was 1855, 1856. It really established him as a unique writer who had this capacity to describe war as it really happens, not as it happens in our romantic imagination or glorified, but really what people go through. Well, War and Peace is the second chapter in that aspect of Tolstoy, and War and Peace was written in the 1860s, and it really put him over the top. It established him not simply as an extraordinarily talented writer, but really as a writer on a par with Homer, Shakespeare, Goethe.
Can you talk about his transformation, Leo Tolstoy's transformation?
Well, Tolstoy actually, I think, was in a constant state of transformation. One of the reasons he's such a fascinating personality is because he was on this constant moral quest for perfection of himself, perfection of the world, and he always came up short. If you read his diaries from when he was in his 20s, his diary entries are extremely entertaining reading because you have him talking about, you know, last night I lost 3,000 rubles at cards. I was, you know, womanizing. I got to bed late. I woke up this morning with a hangover. But today is the day I'm going to reform myself, he would say. And then, of course, the very next day you open his diary. Ah, today I woke up out of bed, you know, at 2 in the morning. I lost another 2,000 rubles last night. So he was constantly trying to improve himself, but he was coming up against his own nature, his own human nature. And then when he was later in life, he went through a major spiritual transformation. He basically in his 50s, he had rejected everything he did up to that point in his life as aristocratic indulgence. And he claims that he lived a debaucherous life and that he was now going to devote the remainder of his career to writing moralistic treatises, essays, political essays, social essays, which is what he did for the next 20 years.
Would you describe him as a pacifist?
Later in his life, after this transition, after this spiritual conversion, sure, Tolstoy was clearly a pacifist. And in fact, he was the originator, one of the original originators of this notion of non-resistance to evil, which was very influential to Gandhi in the 20th century and also to our own Henry David Thoreau in the 19th century.
In fact, he had correspondence with Gandhi.
Correspondence with Gandhi, and also I think with Henry David Thoreau, very interestingly. But you see, earlier in his career, part of the reason that he became a pacifist later on is because earlier in his career, he actually was excited by the whole military experience. He saw the carnage, he saw the suffering, and he depicted that as very few writers ever have. But at the same time, as a young man, there was something in war that was creative, that was stimulating, that was exciting, that really informs a lot of his early war writing. So he had a very contradictory relationship with this thing called war.
Finally, War and Peace, how it changed literature and affected not only the people, the country he lived in, but the people of the world.
War and Peace, there had been novels about war, there had been novels about peace before War and Peace, but there had never been a novel like War and Peace. With War and Peace, Tolstoy really revolutionized not only Russian literature, but European literature. Nobody had seen a work like this before in which there were hundreds and hundreds of characters from all walks of life, multiple plot lines, some intersecting, some just there, characters appearing for 100 pages and then disappearing for 300 pages and reappearing. I mean, people couldn't figure out, what is this thing? This is a massive cornucopia of human experience. And in fact, people weren't even sure what to call War and Peace when it first came out. Henry James, a British writer and critic, called it a loose baggy monsters, precisely because it didn't fit into any neat structural category. But that was Tolstoy's point. You see, Tolstoy's imagination, his sense of life, was too big to be captured in any traditional narrative structure as people had written before. So he had to create his own kind of narrative, and he revolutionized the European novel, and really did a great deal to contribute to the international reputation of Russian culture and Russian literature.
Andy Kaufman, I want to thank you for being with us, visiting lecturer at the University of Virginia, where he teaches Slavic languages and literature. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a documentary produced by the Pacifica Radio Archive about WBAI's War and Peace broadcasts 35 years later. It includes excerpts from the 1970 marathon reading, interviews with the original producers, new readings performed specifically for this broadcast, and a lot more. This is from the Pacifica Radio Archive.
I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. In June 2005, while doing a much-needed inventory, I was going through a shelf of uncatalogued reels. On one, I saw Anne Bancroft's name written on the spine, and next to it was another box, and another after that, with names like Dustin Hoffman, Richard Avedon, Joseph Heller, and legendary Pacifica producer Elsa Knight Thompson. And then I saw the words War and Peace. These were the tapes of one of the most ambitious broadcasts ever. With one of the largest casts, it enthralled all of New York City as it went nonstop day after day. News media wrote about the event, and listeners struggled to stay awake so as not to miss anything. They emptied store shelves of the book throughout the city and gathered to talk about Natasha, Pierre, Napoleon, and his tragic mistakes. During the height of the Vietnam War, when the country was so bitterly divided, the War and Peace broadcast, if only for a few days, brought together Republicans and Democrats, hippies and yippies, veterans and protesters, friends and foe.
Princess Ellen smiled. She rose with that same unchanging smile, the smile of a perfectly beautiful woman with which she had entered the drawing room. There was a slight rustle of her morse and ivy-trimmed ball gown, a gleam of diamonds, lustrous hair, and dazzling white shoulders as she moved toward Anna Pavlovna. Passing between the men who made way for her, not looking directly at any of them, but smiling on all as if graciously granting them the privilege of admiring her beautiful figure, her shapely shoulders, back, and bosom, which, in the fashion of the day, were very much exposed, she seemed to bring with her the glamour of the ballroom. Ellen was so lovely that not only did she show no trace of coquetry, but on the contrary appeared to be almost embarrassed by her undeniable, irresistible, and enthralling beauty. It was as if she wished to diminish its effect while being powerless to do so.
That was August Heckscher, reading from the first few pages of War and Peace. The person who came up with this idea worked in WBAI's Drama and Literature Department on some days, at the switchboard on others, and even hosted her own show on Russian music on other days. Her name is Kathy Dopkin. This is Kathy in an interview from 1970.
I happened to be reading something one day that said that the final volume of War and Peace was sent to the publishers on December 4th, of 1869, and this gave me the idea that till December 4th of 1970, this is the year of the centennial of its publication.
She presented the idea to station management in the form of a memo.
September 28th, 1970. To Bill Henderson and Milton Hoffman, from Kathy, regarding Read the Memo. An absolutely brilliant idea occurred to me over the weekend. Tolstoy's War and Peace was completed, at least the first draft, on December 4, 1869. Therefore, this is the 100th anniversary of this novel, which many have called the greatest book ever written. How about a marathon reading of it, to go on continuously, and to be done a la the Satie Vexations with relay readers, using our staff and our listeners to come and read for a half an hour or for a chapter, etc.? I figure, at 24 hours a day, interrupted occasionally by music, not necessarily Russian, we can do it between Friday primetime and Monday primetime. What you think? Kathy Dopkin.
This was going to be a huge project, primarily because, as Kathy said...
Originally, my idea was to have it done live, because it seemed neat.
If each reader read approximately 10 pages, they would need to be at least 146 readers to get through the 1,455 pages. Almost immediately, Kathy's neat idea was modified to pre-record as many people as possible. One of Kathy Dopkin's biggest supporters was WBAI's drama and literature director, Milton Hoffman. In 1970, during an interview with Kathy, he explained to her his excitement for the project.
When you approached me with the idea, as you said, I was very enthusiastic, and I think that one of the main reasons is that it was the chance to create a very unique radio event and to utilize the freedom that we have at WBAI. The place, you know, WBAI exists because we can do things that no one else can do. And I felt that this would make a very exciting radio event, as I said, as well as using our freedom. Because as we know, freedom doesn't mean anything unless you really try to use it.
With Milton on board, the project began to pick up speed. Management was willing to give them several days to do the reading, but instead of using anonymous volunteers and readers, it was suggested they try to bring in some name people. They had barely 2 months to do the entire project, and they had no idea how to contact celebrities, so they decided to let it be known publicly that they needed readers. Once again, Kathy Dopkin.
There was an item that made the press saying they heard that WBAI had a crazy idea they were going to read all of War and Peace, and I think it said they were looking for actors. We started getting calls, and the press just got hold of it and went with it. But it became such an important event that I think the station really began to back us.
One of the people they convinced to read was Dustin Hoffman. Again, Milton Hoffman, no relation.
I went to Dustin Hoffman's office, which was on the east side of New York, not far from the old WBAI. That's where we actually recorded. He didn't come in, and this was a little office. I remember his first wife was there, and she wasn't sure he should be doing this. But it was clear that, you know, he wanted to make this a good reading.
He slunk to the floor, got the book out, and never looked up, just read. It was wonderful.
Eh bien, mon cher, your little princess is very nice, said the Viscount after seating himself beside Hippolyte in the carriage. Very nice indeed. Kissed the tips of his fingers. And quite French. Hippolyte snickered and burst out laughing. And you know, you're a terrible fellow with that innocent way of yours, continued the Viscount. I pity the poor husband, that little officer who gives himself the airs of a reigning prince. Hippolyte snickered once more, through his laughter retorted, and you said our Russian ladies couldn't compare with your French ladies. One must know how to tackle them.
There were two people in particular that Kathy Dopkin absolutely had to have included in this reading. One was Morris Karnofsky. The other was Leo Tolstoy's daughter, Alexandra. Alexandra was an amazing person in her own right, who, after immigrating to the United States, founded the Tolstoy Foundation. Here is Victoria Wolson, the current executive director of the Tolstoy Foundation, speaking about Alexandra.
She was very concerned to make sure that both educational needs, health concerns, and cultural preservation and ability to view things from a open perspective were propagated and continued along after her father's death in 1910. As I mentioned earlier, she was effectively his secretary and his confidant. So she was really infused with the ideas and ideals of humanitarian work.
We found out that she was in Valley Cottage. I sent her a letter asking her to read. She wrote back that she was ill. I sent her another letter saying that we would come there, we would do anything. She said, well, she just broke her arm. We badgered her. I just kept pushing and pushing. And finally, she said, and I have the letter, well, maybe you guys could come out to Valley Cottage. Only she said it with a very thick Russian accent. Bob Kuttner, who was program director, had a little red Corvette, or the equivalent, little red sports car. And he decided that he would drive Milton and me out to Valley Cottage in the little red Corvette. There were only two seats in the front, so Bob is sitting in the driver's seat. I'm sitting on Milton's lap with the tape recorders and the War and Peace books, which we have here. And we drove a little more, and we entered a little 19th century Russian village with peasants tilling the soil, and Alexandra in her house, in front of all of her father's books, behind a glass cabinet with her arm in a sling. And she read her favorite passage. We asked her what she wanted to read.
The next reader is Alexandra Tolstoy, who will read pages 335 to 344 of her father's novel, War and Peace.
At 8 o'clock, Kutuzov rode to Pratzen at the head of Miloradovich's 4th Column, the one that was to replace Przezhitsevsky's and Langeron's columns, which had already descended the hill. He greeted the men in the foremost regiment and gave the command to advance, thereby indicating that he intended to lead the column himself. On reaching the village of Pratzen, he halted. Prince Andrei was behind him, among the immense number of men comprising the commander-in-chief's suite.
You know, when I met Alexander Tolstoy, I thought, yeah, I say my father, I mean Alexander Dobkin, and Milton says his father. When she says her father, she's speaking of him, of him. She was the youngest daughter. She was with him when he died. And I had read about her my entire life. And this was her dad. Now, he wasn't much of a dad from what I've read. But to be in the same room with Alexander Tolstoy was absolutely, for me, mind-boggling. It was an astonishing feeling.
By this point, Kathy and Milton were bringing in volunteers to help them edit tape. Using razor blades and splicing tape, with that many readers, they needed a team of people working on cleaning up the reads and timing them out and helping them with the schedule.
In walks this person, this Francie Camper. There was something about her that kind of struck us. And she seemed smart, and she had this glint in her eye. But she was volunteering. She was a kid. She was a little tiny girl, for God's sake.
I went to work as a volunteer at WBAI in 1968 at age 14 in order to cut school. You know, it was really a place where you could come up with a creative, innovative idea, and if it had any substance at all to it, the attitude was, yeah, go ahead and do it. And in that kind of atmosphere, an idea gathers so much momentum and so much energy in a positive sense. And then everybody, you know, you always want to be part of something that has those elements.
With Francie Camper editing all the reads, the momentum seemed to push them daily to new ideas and new ways to have fun with this.
At that point, I think we could get back to the original idea of this being a reading of, by, and for the people. We had enough celebrities on board. Certainly, Bob Kuttner and the station was sold on the idea. We were becoming increasingly, I think, aware that we were onto something. And then Kathy would come up, every day we'd go into the station and Kathy or Milton would come up with some idea like, let's get a New York City telephone operator. We did that. Let's get a New York City police officer. Let's look up and see if anybody has the name War and Peace. And we got one of the construction workers who was helping to build the church, the new WBAI studios at that point. And so it was this conglomerate of very well-known and sort of intimidating people who the switchboard operator was thrilled to be screening these calls, and people from the Bronx who would speak about, you know, Natasha and the war.
And for those of you who are unimpressed by big names, they'll also be, among many, many others, a Bronx high school student, New York City police sergeant, a drummer from the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, the foreman from the construction crew that worked on WBAI's new studios, the architect who drew up the designs for WBAI's new studios, representatives from United Nations embassies and consulates, the typesetter of the WBAI folio, secretaries, housewives, businessmen and women, unknown actors, unknown actresses.
WBAI staff members, board members, and volunteers. WBAI subscribers, family, friends, and enemies of all of the above. Truck drivers, telephone operators, and salesmen. Weekend golfers, translators, typists, anchormen, doctors, lawyers, teachers, and many, many more.
No matter who they called and asked to read, it seemed anyone was willing to spend an hour with them reading from the paperback Signet Classic Edition.
So I think you just given the chance to speak Tolstoy's words and knowing that it has some life beyond that moment, I think just sort of had this chemistry, and I think that's the chemistry that sort of carried us all the way through, which is that, you know, you really did build on these experiences, and it was fun. Each one of these people was a lot of fun, but it was also just the beauty of listening to the words being spoken sincerely.
And talking about the words, I think we have to mention that the book we read from, The Signet Paperback, was translated by Ann Dunnigan, and the important thing about it was that it was the first American translation. It had been published just 2 years before, around the same time as the Soviet film came out. And we contacted, and I remember when it came out, I read it and was just bowled over by it, because until then, I think the only translation that was read in English before that was Constance Garnett, which was a very Victorian, very good for its time, but it was an old-fashioned translation. And Ann Dunnigan's was just breathtaking and open and shed whole new light on some of the words, albeit in English translation. And I forget if we contacted her or if she contacted us, but she soon became a very good friend. And she was very helpful and very supportive, and we all went out to dinner. And she was wonderful all the way. She was an amazing person.
And I think what, you know, her translation really does account for a lot of that joy that happened during this, because no one, I don't think any of the readers, and obviously we have this great range of readers, but I don't think any of them felt the text was odd or difficult or of another time. They really, it felt the language was right for 1970, and, you know, she deserves all the credit for that.
This is Ann Dunnigan, translator of War and Peace. Prince Andrei went to dine at the Rostovs and spent the rest of the day there. Everyone in the house realized on whose account he had come, and Prince Andrei, making no secret of it, tried to be with Natasha the whole time. Not only in the soul of the frightened but ecstatically happy Natasha, but throughout the entire household there was a feeling of awed anticipation, as if something of great moment were about to take place. The Countess looked with sad and sternly serious eyes at Prince Andrei when he talked to Natasha, and timidly started some artificial, inconsequential conversation as soon as he looked her way. Sonia was afraid to leave Natasha and afraid of being in the way if she stayed with her. Natasha turned pale in a panic of expectation every time she was left alone with him for a moment.
It was, in the end, the power of the idea and just the appealing quality of it, that there was no other agenda. We weren't trying to do anything except have this great celebration of this great book. And mostly, when you get people on the phone, they'd say yes simply because everybody thought it sounded like fun. And I just want to say, I think it could not have happened without being at Pacifica. This is an event that is, in terms of broadcasting, that is only Pacifica. There is no other way it could have happened, no other set of circumstances that led up to it. And as I said, I think it really is historically important that we invented the marathon broadcast.
Yes, 35 years ago, December 2nd to December 6th, 1970, WBAI's historic War and Peace broadcast. The documentary you have heard is part of a two-hour documentary that you can get at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Today, Pacifica and community and public radio stations around the country are celebrating this historic broadcast. When we come back, Helen Thomas, the veteran journalist, reads Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Stay with us. Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 400 radio and TV stations around the country and the world, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS stations and both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 35 years after WBAI's 1970 War and Peace broadcast, the Pacifica Radio Archive gathered actors, activists, scholars, journalists to read sections of the epic novel. Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas was one of the people invited. She's commonly referred to as the First Lady of the Press. Helen Thomas is the most senior member of the White House Press Corps. She served as White House correspondent for United Press International for nearly 60 years, has covered every president since John F. Kennedy, now a columnist for Hearst newspapers. President Gerald Ford once remarked, "If God created the earth in 6 days, he couldn't have rested on the seventh. He would have had to explain it to Helen Thomas." The Pacifica Radio Archive asked the veteran journalist to read an excerpt of Leo Tolstoy's epic work, War and Peace.
I'm Helen Thomas, a Hearst newspaper's columnist, and I'm about to read excerpts from Chapter 19 of Tolstoy's War and Peace. On the Pratzen Heights, where he had fallen with his flagstaff in his hands, lay Prince Andrei Bolkonsky, bleeding profusely and unconsciously, uttering soft, pitiful, childish moans. Toward evening, he stopped moaning and became quite still. He did not know how long he had remained unconscious. Suddenly, he again felt that he was alive and suffering from a burning, lacerating pain in his head. "Where is it? That lofty sky I never knew till now, and only now saw today," was his first thought. "This suffering, too, I did not know before," he thought. "No, I knew nothing, nothing till now. But where am I?" He listened and caught the sound of approaching horses and of voices speaking French. He opened his eyes. Above him, once more, there was the lofty sky with rising clouds through which he glimpsed that blue infinity. He did not turn his head and did not see those who, judging by the sounds of hoofbeats and voices, had ridden up to him and stopped. It was Napoleon, accompanied by his two aides-de-camp, making a tour of the battlefield. Bonaparte had given final orders to strengthen the batteries firing on the Agest Dam and was looking over the dead and wounded left on the field. "Fine man," observed Napoleon, looking at a dead Russian grenadier who lay on his stomach with his face plunged into the earth, the back of his neck blackened, and one already stiffened arm flung wide. "The battery guns have exhausted their ammunition, sire," reported an adjutant who had just come from the batteries firing on the Augest. "Have some brought up from the reserve," said Napoleon. And having gone a few steps, he stopped and looked down at Prince Andrei, who lay on his back with the flagstaff that had been dropped beside him. The flag had already been taken by the French as a trophy. "That's a fine death," said Napoleon, gazing at Bolkonsky. Prince Andrei realized that this was said of him and that it was Napoleon who said it. He heard the speaker of these words addressed as sire, but he heard the words as he might have heard the buzzing of a fly. Not only did they not interest him, but he took no notice of them, instantly forgot them. His head was burning. He felt he was losing blood and saw above him the remote, lofty, eternal heavens. He knew that it was Napoleon, his hero, but at that moment, Napoleon seemed to him such a small, insignificant creature. compared to with what was taking place between his soul and that lofty, infinite sky with the clouds sailing over it. At that moment, it meant absolutely nothing to him who might be standing over him or what might be said of him. He was only glad there were people there, only wished that they could help him and bring him back to life, which seemed to him so beautiful now that he understood it differently. He made a supreme effort to stir and utter a sound. He feebly moved his leg and produced a faint, sickly moan that roused his own pity. "Ah, he is alive," said Napoleon. "Pick up this young man and bring him to the dressing station." Having said this, Napoleon rode on to meet Marshal Lannes, who hat in hand and smiling, rode up to the emperor to congratulate him on his victory. Prince Andrei remembered nothing more. He lost consciousness from the terrible pain of being lifted onto a stretcher. The jolting while being moved and the probing of his wound at the dressing station. He regained consciousness only toward the end of the day when the other wounded had captured Russian officers, he was moved to a hospital. During this transfer, he felt a little stronger and was able to look around him and even to speak. The first words he heard on regaining consciousness were those of a French convoy officer hurriedly saying, "We must halt here. The emperor will be coming this way, and it will please him to see these gentlemen prisoners. There are so many prisoners today, almost the whole Russian army, and he's probably sick of looking at them," said another officer. "Well, anyhow, this one, they say, is the commander of all, the Emperor Alexander's guards," said the first officer, pointing to a wounded Russian officer in the white uniform of the Horse Guards. Bolkonsky recognized Prince Repnin, whom he had met in Petersburg society. Beside him stood a youth of 19, a wounded officer of the Horse Guards. Bonaparte rode up at a gallop and reined in his horse. "Who is the senior officer here?" he asked on seeing the prisoners. They named the colonel Prince Repnin. "You are the commander of Emperor Alexander's regiment of Horse Guards?" asked Napoleon. "I commanded a squadron," replied Repnin. "Your regiment performed its duty honorably," said Napoleon. Quote, "The praise of a great commander is a soldier's highest reward," replied Repnin. "I bestow it with pleasure," said Napoleon. "And who is that young man beside you?" Prince Repnin named Lieutenant Sukhalin. Looking at him, Napoleon smiled and said, "He's rather young to come and meddle with us." "Youth is no impediment to courage," murmured the young man, his voice breaking. "A fine answer," said Napoleon. "Young man, you will go far." Prince Andrei, who had been brought forward to complete the show of prisoners for the emperor, could not fail to attract his notice. Napoleon apparently remembered seeing him on the field and addressed him with the same epithet, "young man," with which he had at first addressed Bolkonsky, and that was associated in his memory. "And you, young man," he said. "Well, how are you feeling, mon brave?" Although 5 minutes before, Prince Andrei had been able to say a few words to the soldiers who were carrying him, now with his eyes fixed on Napoleon, he was silent. So trivial at that moment seemed to him all the interest that engrossed Napoleon. So petty did his hero himself seem, with his paltry vanity and joy in victory, appeared compared with the lofty, equitable, benevolent sky which he had seen and understood, that he could not answer him. Indeed, everything seemed to him so futile and insignificant in comparison with that solemn and sublime train of thought which weakness, loss of blood, suffering, and the nearness of death had induced in him. Looking into Napoleon's eyes, Prince Andrei thought of the insignificance of greatness, the unimportance of life, which no one could understand, and of the still greater unimportance of death, the meaning of which no living person could understand and explain.
Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas reading an excerpt of Leo Tolstoy's classic work, War and Peace. After the reading, Pacifica reporter Mitch Jezerich interviewed Helen Thomas. He began by asking her why War and Peace was one of her favorite books.
Well, I think it covers our lifetime. Since I've been reporting, we've been through many wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf Wars, now the war with Iraq, and God knows so many other little skirmishes. And I just think it's so profound that it's so much a part of our lives. I hope from now on we'll see peace.
Yeah. Now, you read chapter 19 of book 1. Why did you choose
that? I was profoundly moved by that chapter because it really seemed to personify the whole book in terms of what it was all about. In the end, what is significant and what is important? Family, the blue skies, eternity, and Napoleon and so forth, the leaders who make and break our lives.
You speak of your experience covering government, covering the White House for several decades now. Throughout what you've seen, throughout your career, how does something like War and Peace relate to your experience in covering the White House?
You always feel and hope that whoever lives in the White House is a man of peace and will work in every possible way to the last resort for peace. Because war is horrible. There are no winners, really, in the end. So much pain and so forth, and so unnecessary. There are peaceful solutions to most problems. If we're attacked, of course we would have to go to war. But I never want my country to provoke a war that is against a country that did nothing to us, and I feel that's what's happened in Iraq.
And is that the idea behind the title even of the book, War and Peace, the struggle between war and peace?
I think it so exemplifies even wars today. War is war, no matter what era, no matter what century.
Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas. She was not the only one to read Tolstoy's novel for Pacifica Radio. We end today with some of the voices that continue the War and Peace epic.
This is Robert Fisk, a Middle East correspondent of the London Independent, reading War and Peace in this edition from page 971 to 980.
Hi, I'm Maria Hinojosa. I'm reading pages 1,285 to 1,288 from War.
This is Mike Farrell. I'm reading chapter 14, pages 13, 26, 27, and 28.
This is Ed Asner. I'm reading War and Peace from pages 1338 to 1343.
This is War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. This is Mumia Abu Jamal. From that time up to the end of the campaign, all Kutuzov's activity was limited to trying, by the exercise of authority, by guile, and by entreaties, to hold his army back from useless attacks, maneuvers, and skirmishes with the perishing enemy. The Turov marched to Male Yaroslavets, but Kutuzov lingered with the main army and gave orders for the clearing of the Kaluga, retreat beyond which seemed to Kutuzov quite possible. Everywhere Kutuzov retreated, but the enemy, without waiting for him to retire, fled back in the opposite direction. Napoleon's historians described to us his skillful maneuvers at Turritino and at Mele Yaroslavets, and discuss what would have happened if Napoleon had succeeded in making his way to the wealthy provinces of the South. But to say nothing of the fact that nothing hindered Napoleon from marching into those southern provinces since the Russian army left the road open, the historians forget that nothing could have saved Napoleon's army because it carried within itself at that time the inevitable germs of ruin. Why should that army, which found abundant provisions in Moscow and could not keep them but trampled them underfoot, that army which could not store supplies on entering Smolensk but plundered at random, why should that army have mended its ways in the Kaluga province, where the inhabitants were of the same Russian race as in Moscow, and where fire had the same aptitude for destroying whatever they set fire to? The army could not have recovered itself anyway. From the Battle of Borodino and the sacking of Moscow, it bore within itself, as it were, the chemical elements of dissolution. The men of what had been an army fled with their leaders, not knowing whither they went. Napoleon, and every soldier with him, filled with one desire, to make his own escape as quickly as might be from the hopeless position of which all were dimly aware. At the council in Mele Yaroslavets, when the French generals affected to be delivered...
Mumia Abu-Jamal, Robert Fisk, Maria Hinojosa, Helen Thomas, Ed Asner, and many more reading from Leo Tolstoy's epic novel, War and Peace. The Pacifica Radio Archive is spending the day bringing you excerpts, past and present, as we honor WBAI in New York 35 years ago, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the publication of War and Peace. If you'd like to hear the old readings and the new, if you'd like to hear the two-hour documentary produced by Brian DeShazer and Christopher Sprinkle and Mark Torres and the Pacifica Radio Archive, you can go to their website at pacificaradioarchives.org. The power of community media. Democracy Now! Is brought to you by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdo-Kadous and John Hamilton and Anna Nagara and Elizabeth Press and Yoruba Richin and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. At our website, democracynow.org, you can link to the different aspects of this broadcast. Again today, the 35th anniversary of the first marathon radio broadcast in history. WBAI, spending 4.5 days, ending today, December 6th, but it was in 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War. The marathon reading interrupted only by the nightly war report, bringing you the reports from Vietnam. Today, we remember this in the midst of the war in Iraq. DemocracyNow.org is our website, where you can go to sign up to get our daily headlines, let other people know about this daily grassroots global, unembedded, independent, international news hour. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.